mindfulness practice at its core is about learning how to be compassionate towards yourself, like learning how to be a good friend to yourself. My meditation teacher was very fond of saying, having your own mind be kind to itself is your birthright. And he used to say that, and I would be like, but now I see just how true that is.
Hi, I'm Hallie Ritsu.
And I'm Allison Friedman.
And this is Personal Jurisdiction,
a podcast where we get personal with lawyers about their journeys before, during, and after law school.
Join us for season 3 as our guests share their behind-the-scenes reflections on the highs and lows of how they got to where they are today. On today's episode, we welcome Gina Cho. Gina Cho is a lawyer, author, and mindfulness consultant and coach. She speaks and writes about wellness, self-care, and mindfulness. Gina also works with lawyers and law firms on stress management, work-life balance, and career transition. Gina is an attorney with over 15 years of experience in the practice of law and who brings her personal experience as an immigrant, a Korean American, and a mom to the table. Her work is steeped in science and research-based expertise in mindfulness, positive psychology, cognitive behavioral tools, and coaching. Gina's a graduate of the University at Buffalo and the University at Buffalo School of Law. Gina is also the co-author of The Anxious Lawyer, an 8-week guide to a joyful and satisfying law practice. Please enjoy our conversation with Gina Cho. Welcome back to Personal Jurisdiction. We are here today with Gina Cho. Gina, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Gina, we're going to start where we've started now for going on 3 seasons. And that is to ask you, why did you go to law school?
So I am an immigrant. I am a child immigrant. So I came over to this country when I was 10 and with my parents. And, you know, I think this is a fairly common experience for so many immigrants. Like, you're in a new country, you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, you don't know how the legal system works. So growing up, you know, I saw my parents get taken advantage of a fair amount. And I also love the show Law and Order. I was obsessed yes. with the show. I used to watch it religiously. So I credit Law and Order for teaching me how to speak English.
Amazing.
And I wanted to be just like the lawyers on TV. You know, I had this very naive understanding of how our justice system works. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. If I become a lawyer, then I can correct all the injustices of the world. So that's what I set out to do. And that's what led me to becoming a lawyer.
Gina, we know that you are currently focusing on mindfulness as a mindfulness coach and consultant, but we want to just take a few minutes to talk about your legal career before you got into that. So we know that you were both an assistant state attorney, and then you also practiced bankruptcy law. So can you tell us how it was that you sort of made your way from the TV side of things into those couple of jobs?
Sure. So when I became an assistant state attorney, I realized that, of course, reality is very, very different than what you see on TV. So I was an assistant state attorney in Florida, and I very quickly realized that, you know, I felt like I had a lot more in common with the people that we were prosecuting than, I guess, some of my other white colleagues. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, one of the cases that we used to prosecute was driving without a valid license. So just to kind of, you know, set the stage, right? Driving without a valid license is a law that is designed to make sure that your license doesn't expire, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want people driving with expired licenses. So for US citizens and for people who are here that have documents, it's just a matter of going and renewing your driver's license. And then, you know, and everything is fine. Typically, it's just a warning. But for the undocumented immigrants in Florida, they were using this law as like a way to prosecute undocumented immigrants, which the law was never actually intended to be used in that way. And I remember just feeling so traumatized by that experience of seeing these undocumented immigrants get sent to jail They didn't injure anyone. They didn't harm anyone. Like their only sort of crime, and I'm using my air quotation here, was the fact that they didn't have a valid license. And I remember just feeling just so distraught. And as an immigrant myself, so, you know, I got to really see how our justice system works and in many ways doesn't work. You know, I was also assigned to the domestic violence court, and it was also, you know, really heartbreaking because often the victims would kind of try to negotiate with me that she didn't, typically female, didn't want her perpetrator to go to jail. Sometimes because she loved them, but often because she was financially dependent on him. Yeah. And I just realized like, oh, you know what? Our justice system is just so deeply broken. And I really struggled with being a part of that brokenness. So eventually I got out of practicing as an assistant state attorney and I shifted to bankruptcy. And I sort of fell into practicing bankruptcy because, you know, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I definitely didn't want to do criminal law. I didn't want to do family law. Like there were definitely areas of law that I didn't want to do, but I did want to have that connection with my clients and also kind of help people that are just like everyday people, like yeah. people who I relate to. And I was working as a pro bono attorney for AIDS Legal Referral Panel. So it's an organization that helps people who are infected with HIV and AIDS. And so I took this kind of like 8-hour class where you learn an area of law and they assign you a mentor and then you're assigned a pro bono case. So I just like bankruptcy, that's not something I'm familiar with. So I took the 8-hour class and then I was assigned a pro bono client. And I remember he was from Mexico. So he was an immigrant, just like myself. And he had, in addition to having AIDS, he had bipolar disorder. So when he was on his high, he would go on these shopping sprees. Mm-hmm. So his sort of overspending was really caused by his mental illness. And he was convinced that he was going to be sent to jail for all of his debts. Yet he was like basically insolvent. You know, his only sort of income was Social Security disability. So I said, no, I think we can put you through bankruptcy. And I did, you know, I filed this case. And at the end of his case, I remember he just hugged me and was crying. Aww. And I thought, oh, you know, this feels like an area of law where I can really make a direct impact on the people that I'm helping. So that's how I ended up practicing bankruptcy law for, you know, like 10 years.
And Gina, so your perspective on law started kind of just seeing on TV and in the media, lawyers portrayed in this heroic role. And then you had some different experiences through the criminal justice system and then through your bankruptcy practice. What did you like about the practice of law? Or what do you like about the practice of law?
So many things. You know, I think it is just such a great profession for making a difference in the world. And even though sometimes it literally just feels like adding drops of water into, you know, a large body pool of water, that we can use our skills and knowledge and our talents for a source of good. In all the bankruptcy cases, I really enjoy getting to know the clients, getting to hear their stories, and then helping them through this really difficult journey. You know, often people end up filing for bankruptcy because they go through some type of life trauma. So, you know, unexpected illnesses, unexpected deaths, right? Business deals gone awry. And it, you know, I sort of love the personal side of practicing law. And certainly having my own practice made a huge difference, right? Being my own boss, taking the clients that I wanted to take was also a different experience than being assigned all of my cases.
Gina, what drove you to start meditating?
I was just full of anxiety, I think, like so many lawyers.
Yes, we can both relate to that.
Definitely.
Yeah, you know, I realized I was just constantly in like survival mode. You know, I was just constantly doing. And I guess to, you know, just back up a little bit, part of what drove me to become a lawyer was this very high sense of expectation that I had for myself. And I think a lot of women struggle with this, right? Certainly women, people of color, I think often struggle with this, and certainly my, you know, Korean American background. And so that expectation of perfection led to the feelings of imposter syndrome, right? Feeling like I'm never good enough, never smart enough. And I always sort of compensated for that by overworking. Like overworking was just the norm for me. And I always took pride in the fact that I can outwork everyone. Like I may not be the smartest person in the room, but I know I can outwork everyone in the room. And I think just that way of thinking kind of unchecked led to, you know, some like mental health or mental well-being issues. You know, like the only thing that I was doing was work. Like I had my husband who was also my law partner. So like we were never like not at work.
Really intertwined, you know?
Yeah. Really intertwined. And then also I really took the stories and the experiences of my clients to heart. So I would often think about my clients. I had a hard time sort of separating myself from work. My mind was at work all the time. And so I started practicing mindfulness and meditation because actually a friend of mine who's a therapist was like, yeah, Gina, it sounds like maybe you might have some mental health issues that you might want to look into. And that's sort of how I got into practicing mindfulness and meditation.
Gina, we know that you actually wrote a book called The Anxious Lawyer, which I have a copy of right here and is incredible and such a helpful guide for lawyers. I think, you know, you have pointed out that so many lawyers, we tend to be so hard on ourselves. And as you said, so much in the realm of perfectionism and all of these things that we don't tend to be as introspective. I'm making a generalization. Not all lawyers are have that issue, but certainly I know I have. I very much identify with the idea of being proud of being the hardest working person in the room and wearing that sort of as a badge of honor and not really reflecting on kind of what that does for your mental health. So I'm curious how you went from starting to meditate and sort of internalize your own mental health struggles, if I can call them that, and then deciding to actually spread the word and write this book and help other people, especially lawyers, to identify with a mindfulness practice.
Yeah, it was definitely a journey. You know, sometimes I think some people have this idea that I wrote a business plan, like a 12-part plan and executed it. It was nothing like that. So I started practicing mindfulness and meditation kind of as part of my anxiety treatment. So I was in this like group anxiety management treatment program. And part of what we had to do was to do the thing that scared us. And at the time, the thing that most provoked anxiety was public speaking. And, you know, I think that's pretty common for a lot of people. And at the end of this, I can't remember, you know, like 3 or 4 month, could have been 6 months, treatment program, we had to kind of make a commitment to do something to continue our journey towards healing and wholeness. And so I said, well, I'm going to do the thing that scares me the most, being the overachiever that I am. And I said, I'm going to do one public speaking engagement a month for a whole year. Because after the year was up, we would actually go back and meet with the therapist again and just check in. And once I kind of started to think about, well, what is the thing that I want to talk about? I very quickly realized I didn't really have a whole lot of pull towards talking about bankruptcy law, which, you know, probably would have been sort of the natural thing that I could have talked about. But I was on one of the committees at our local bar association. And so I just approached them and I said, hey, you know, I'm learning all of these tools for how to manage stress and anxiety more effectively. And it's working in my own life. And I feel like these are tools that we should be teaching every single lawyer. Can I just do like an hour long presentation on that topic? So then they were like, yeah, that sounds great. Come and do it. So I did. That's how I started. So I think I ended up doing like 12 that first year. And then the word spreads, right? You do one presentation, bunch of lawyers come, and then they like what you have to say. So they go back to their law firm and tell their PD people about it. And then you get invited to speak at a law firm event and so on and so forth. So I think like the next year I ended up doing something like 27, and it just kind of grew from there. And the book kind of came about sort of in an unexpected way. So this person that I know from Twitter, I also wrote a book for the American Bar Association. And he was like, hey, my editor is going to be in San Francisco for the ABA conference. Like, you guys should connect. So I was like, okay, well, that sounds good. And at the end of my conversation with the editor, he goes, so do you have a book proposal for me? And I was like, yeah, like exactly the face Allison, you made. That was a face that I made. And I didn't go into the conversation thinking he was going to ask me for a book proposal. Like, you know, I was like, who am I to do a book proposal? But I think this was kind of almost where I had like a divine intervention, because literally the words that popped out of my mouth was, yes, I want to write a book. I want to write a book for lawyers on mindfulness and meditation. And I want to title it The Anxious Lawyer. And like, as the words were coming out of my mouth, I had this sensation of like wanting to grab it and pull them back and like withdraw it. It's like, no, strike that. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, you're going to write a book.
Am I actually going to write a book? Yeah.
But yeah, I really just feel like there was something inside of me that was just in that moment, like raise her hand that said, yes, pick me. And it was definitely one of those moments where I was like, who is this person? But that's how I ended up with the book deal. It was just like so random, and it couldn't, I don't, you know, sometimes I think about it and I go, wow, that was just really, what a... you know, just set of like bunch of different random circumstances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having had these type of conversations with lots of people, I don't think that it's like an unusual story. You know, it's like, I can't remember what the quote is, but it's like success is like where preparation meets luck or something like that, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
I want to go back to a little bit more about some particulars of mindfulness practice in a minute. But since we're talking about how you started with challenging yourself to do these presentations and then being asked to do more and more, and then creating this book proposal kind of on the fly and writing this book, when did you decide to transition to being a full-time mindfulness consultant and coach? And what was that thought process like for you?
It happened during the pandemic, actually. So I had my daughter in May of 2019, and my husband and I were still running our law practice at that time. And just something shifted in my brain. Like once I had Simone, my brain just said, okay, like we can't rent anymore. We need to buy a house. I was nesting hardcore. So we moved from the Bay Area to the Sacramento area. And then of course the pandemic hit just March after that. And my husband decided that he wanted to shift. So he is now a bankruptcy specialist for the California government, for the Franchise Tax Board. So once he kind of got the job and transitioned out, I had the decision of I can either run the law firm by myself or we can close the business. And I just knew at the time, you know, I had an infant, like a very young infant in home. There was a pandemic happening. I still had my consulting and coaching business. And I knew I didn't have the bandwidth to run the practice anymore, especially not by myself. So that's kind of what led to me stopping practicing altogether. Just, you know, a bunch of set of life circumstances. So again, it wasn't by some great design. It's just, it happened that way.
So now that you are doing mindfulness coaching and consulting full time, I'm curious, what would you recommend for law students, for young lawyers who want to incorporate mindfulness into their daily practice, and maybe in particular just want to get started? I know there's a little bit of a hurdle for a lot of people to saying, okay, I'm actually going to do this. So what would you recommend?
Well, getting a copy of my book, The Anxious Lawyer, is a great place to start because it has like an 8-week program built into it, which I knew would work well for the lawyers who kind of need very specific, like, here are the instructions on how to get you from A to Z, right? We like
so
getting
helpful.
The syllabus. We like having the curriculum. You know, I think there are a few different things to starting and creating a habit of mindfulness. So often I feel like what lawyers try to do is to kind of learn intellectually a lot about mindfulness and meditation. They want to study it like they would study law, but they are for various reasons, kind of hesitant to embody a daily practice. And all the research, like every single research that has been done around the effectiveness of mindfulness and meditation, really shows is the regularity of the practice much more so than the duration of any single practice. So really the thing to remember is do the practice, right? And, you know, the practice can look very, very different from one person to the next. For some, it's literally just 2 minutes a day. And when lawyers ask me like, oh, how long should I meditate for? I always tell them 2 minutes a day. And they always look at me like, oh, they're kind of dissatisfied with that answer. They were expecting me to say like 90 minutes. And right. I'm like, okay, well, I can tell you 90 minutes, but yeah. I know that's not realistic. Like 2 minutes, I was like, try for 2 minutes. And I use 2 minutes because there's a researcher, Sean Ecker. He wrote the book, The Happiness Advantage. His research shows that 2 minutes a day over 21 days is enough to have a measurable difference from meditating every day. I'm like, 2 minutes, 21 days, try it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the 21 days, if you're like, oh, that was too easy, you know, you can bump it up to 5 minutes. And, you know, but for a lot of people, like doing it 2 minutes every day is also a challenge, right? So I think 2 minutes a day, there are so many different apps out there. The one that I use is called Insight Timer. I have a couple of my guided meditations on there as well. But there's, you know, Headspace, there's Calm, there are so many different types of apps. I will say there's sort of this like seductive trap that I see lawyers sometimes fall into where they download all the apps and then they want to sample it all. That was me. Best meditation, and they wasted, you know, like 4 hours, right? Uh-huh. It's like, okay, I think just kind of pick one, find like one that is tolerable for you, you know? And then when the pandemic started, I started doing a daily-ish, I say daily-ish because it's basically Monday through Thursday at 9:30 Pacific, I do a daily Zoom session. It's just 10 minutes. It's kind of lawyers from all across the country. I offer it on a donation basis. So if you want sort of like a more live in-person handholding, you're also welcome to join me for that as well.
I love that. That's awesome that you have that live in-person and sort of an accountability thing. And I also love the 2 minutes. Like, I feel like anyone can do 2 minutes. Although, as you said, you know, over 21 days, you do have to actually mindfully carve out the time to make sure you're doing it. But that's great advice because it's not, as you said, 90 minutes, which I think would be prohibitive for a lot of people to try to actually start a mindfulness practice.
Yeah, it is definitely not a more is better practice.
I liked when you told us when we first talked recently, don't over-prepare, just dive in. Because I was the person who, I probably still have all the apps on my phone, like looking for the best one, what can I really do? But now that you're explaining it to me again, 2 minutes sounds like something I can handle. It doesn't have to be the perfect setting, the perfect app, anything like that. That's really helpful, I think, especially for our lawyer brains. Gina, so I first met you through LinkedIn because I saw your post. You're really active on LinkedIn and sharing resources about mindfulness, and especially mindfulness for women lawyers. And in particular, you have shared a lot about mindfulness and the experience of being a mom. So I wonder if you could share with us just how being a mom has changed your perspective on legal practice and mindfulness. You told us a little bit about your decisions that you made in transitioning your career, but I wonder what else you have to share with us on that topic.
Oh, I love this question. Being a mom, I think, just foundationally changed me in so many ways. And then this is a realization that I think I had more recently, just in the last, probably this year, is the importance of being rather than doing. So I've been really much more intentional about carving out blocks of time on my calendar so I can really be present with her, but also carving out time for just me without her. So I go on retreats and I'm very intentional about just doing things for my own well-being. And, you know, it's also made me think much more deeply about our society at large, especially, you know, around the topic around race, like race, gender, and all the inequalities. So my daughter is biracial, my husband is white, I'm Korean American, and really feeling into like, what does it mean to be a biracial person in this country where you are embracing both cultures? Like, what does it mean for me to, you know, provide an environment where my daughter can grow up and really take pride in both her Korean culture and also her whiteness, you know? And I think there's like so much to unpack about that. I think it's also made me think more deeply around trauma and how trauma lives in the body and how it, you know, we can inadvertently pass on trauma to our children if we don't tend to it. So I've been much more intentional about tending to my own trauma, which requires that we stop and pause and actually break that cycle of that constant like override and overwhelm. And I think so, you know, we're constantly on this like treadmill and we're like, you know, overriding that sense of overwhelm that, you know, I think it's just ever so present. And I'm just so much more aware of the preciousness of every single day, you know, and like watching her grow up to be a little human and just like how much goes into fostering and creating an environment where a human being can thrive. Yeah, I think.
Yeah. No, that's
some of the areas that come up for me.
That's so lovely. I'm struck by the fact that a lot of the things you're describing, like trauma, race, gender, all these things are things that I deal with clients oftentimes in the legal clinic setting with my students. And so I'm curious, obviously, for you, you know, seeing it and grappling with it through the eyes of your daughter is a bit different than grappling with it through the trauma or something that a client may be experiencing. But I'm curious how you think mindfulness or mindfulness practice might sort of help lawyers who are grappling with those things maintain a practice over a long period of time, because I think there is a lot of burnout and stress and anxiety that comes with secondary trauma or when you're dealing with clients who are sort of having some of these major dilemmas or issues. So yeah, is there a way that mindfulness can be sort of incorporated to help lawyers sort of maintain a long-term practice in that sense?
Yeah. I think before I directly answer that question, I want to just pause and say that for anyone listening, if, you know, just like really underlining the importance of getting professional mental health help when you need it. Like sometimes I feel like we can talk about these like well-being activities and mindfulness and meditation. And so like, if you just do that consistently enough, if you just like, you can sort of self-care your way into, you know, fixing a mental illness. And that's not the case. No. It's sort of like, you know, if you need a open heart surgery, you would go see a surgeon. Like, yes, eating a, you know, healthy diet and meditating and going for walks and connection with others, all of those things help, but it's not a substitute. So I want to just kind of preface what I'm about to say by saying that. And at its core, mindfulness is about using your direct sense of observation to become aware of what is happening in the moment. So I think just being able to kind of slow down enough to notice like, oh, this person is sharing something that is deeply traumatizing and noticing how it feels in the body, right? Like noticing, oh, I'm really feeling dysregulated. I am feeling my body like rise with heat, or I'm feeling rage, or I'm feeling deep sense of sadness or helplessness, or actually being able to name those things and like slow it down. And also like tending to the body. I think so often lawyers have this false belief that like who they are is their intellect and not realize there's a whole body attached to the brain.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think mindfulness also gives you that practice of witnessing the suffering of others, like our clients, without completely losing ourselves in that suffering, right? Which is not where we want to be either, but also not disengage, right? Sometimes I think we can kind of go into that kind of blocking, you know, where we're not really engaging with our clients. Like we, it's almost like a dissociation that can happen. And finally, you know, mindfulness practice at its core is about learning how to be compassionate towards yourself, like learning how to be a good friend to yourself. My meditation teacher was very fond of saying, having your own mind be kind to itself is your birthright. And he used to say that, and I would be like, but now I see just how true that is. And so, you know, in those really, really difficult moments where things don't go your way, or maybe like you made a mistake, right? I mean, that also happens, right? It's like, how do you not get lost in that like berating yourself or that endless cycle of self-criticism and self-hatred? Because that's not really going to get you anywhere. That's not a terribly productive way of thinking. And you know, into something more helpful, something that is more, you know, maybe productive. And also, you know, mindfulness like trains your mind to stay in the present moment. So you're not constantly doing the thing where you're thinking about some hearing that's 2 months away. Yes. Or my favorite, having those fantasy conversations with like the judge or the opposing counsel months and months and months later. Yeah. I jokingly tell people that I started practicing mindfulness and meditation because I got tired of showering with all of my clients. Like I was just like, every morning I would get in the shower and as I'm shampooing my hair, I would go through all of my clients and I would have like these fantasy conversations where I'm like, I told you not to do that thing and how dare you do that thing and then blame me for the outcome that I warned you against. Like, no, like I'm in the shower, like I can turn it into a very relaxing and soothing activity. And thinking about my clients does not lend itself to a soothing and calming activity. Like being able to like manage your own brain, right, mm-hmm. is, you know, really what you're learning.
That's so great. I can definitely identify with that. Gina, as we're thinking about what kind of advice you might have in particular for new lawyers or law students, especially as it relates to imposter syndrome. That was something you mentioned earlier in our conversation and something you've spoke on quite a bit in CLEs and otherwise. What is your advice for law students or new lawyers who may be experiencing imposter syndrome?
So when I think back on my legal career, and I think about imposter syndrome as like having like two different root causes, you know, one is sort of my own internal wiring, right? And also, you know, a lot of the messages that I got from my parents and probably from my culture around how I needed to be in the world, you know, this like expectation of perfection. And I will also say that the legal system as a whole, I think, perpetuates imposter syndrome for lots and lots of different reasons. And I think it's also more prevalent for what I would say, like, for lawyers who didn't come off the assembly line as with, like, the default setting. Mm-hmm. You're not, like, a white male lawyer, mm-hmm. you know, heterosexual, cisgender, like, anything that deviates from that factory standard, it's hard, right? Like, yeah. So, you know, when I first started practicing, I didn't have any role models for a lawyer who looks like me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in an office that probably had close to 100 attorneys, and maybe had two or three attorneys of color. So, you know, it took me a really long time to realize, like, oh, you know what? Just because the way that I practice law is different than how the white male lawyer, you know, I think like we can all sort of think about like the stereotypical lawyer, right? And
definitely.
If you don't follow that, it can lend itself to that feeling of the imposter syndrome. So I would say, you know, really kind of look around and find mentors and find people who you admire, who you aspire to be more like in your law practice. And sometimes this might require that you go outside of your immediate circle, right? Yeah. Or people in your firm to be able to find the people who you want to be more like. And also I would say be discerning. I think sometimes, you know, the feedback that you get as a young lawyer is much more of a reflection on the person giving the feedback than it is about you. Like for me, you know, like a very concrete example that comes to mind is the first attorney that I was assigned to. So the partner would often say to me, like, Gina, you're never going to make it as a trial lawyer because you are too timid, you're too soft spoken. Like, you don't have what it takes to be a trial lawyer. And he would be like, you have to just be more aggressive. You know, you have to really raise your voice. Like, I mean, all the advice that we know from social science research that if I took on any of those personalities or traits, right, I would be labeled the B word.
Of course.
Whereas for him, you know, he had a very different experience. So, yeah, so I think, you know, just being like aware of those issues and also like, you know, I think having people and that sense of connection outside of the law is also really important. You know, like having people who you can share hobbies with and do different activities with, right? Yeah. I think we can just get so like immersed in our work that we kind of lose a sense of who we are. Mm-hmm. So people can kind of keep you tethered to, you know, to yourself.
Mm-hmm. And to who you are outside of being a lawyer. That's such great advice, Gina. And I would love your thoughts on our final question that we love to ask all of our guests. And that is, what does success mean to you?
You know, literally the first example that comes to mind is my daughter. When she first started to talk, one of the first like complete sentences she would say is, I am so proud of you. And so she would look at me and she would say, I'm so proud of you, mommy. And I don't know, you know, for me, like to me, that's like such a sign of success, right?
Definitely.
That my little, you know, 2-year-old, but also like, where did she get that from? Right?
Yeah.
It's like, I say it to her all the time and now she's repeating it back to me. And I was thinking like, oh, you know, how rarely I say that to myself, yet I say that to other people all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So I think just kind of, and I don't know if this is really responsive to your question, but like, I think just having that sense of pride in yourself, right? Even if it deviates sort of from this the standard checklist of what society dictates as being successful, like having your own internal yardstick for what success looks like for you. Mm-hmm. And for me, like success is like being present for my daughter and spending really, you know, lots of quality time with her, taking, you know, really good care of myself. And then of course, you know, serving my clients as well. But, you know, it certainly has deviated a lot from what I sort of defined as success at the beginning of my career.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's something we've heard from many of our guests too, is that that definition changes, grows, becomes very different than maybe it was at the beginning of our careers. Gina, I just want to let our listeners know that they can find you online at ginacho.com and that your book, The Anxious Lawyer, is available on your website, at local bookstores, and online as an Audible audiobook too, and that they can follow you on LinkedIn. Again, that's where we got to know you, and I really find your posts and your reflections so helpful. You also have a newsletter for mindfulness tips and updates, and we will post all of this information in our show notes so that if you'd like to follow Gina and maybe join her for a daily meditation via Zoom, you can do that. Otherwise, thank you so much for joining us on the episode today. It was great to speak with you and to learn more about your career and your mindfulness practice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't go away. There's more to come in the due diligence portion of our show.
Hi, everyone. We are back for due diligence related to our episode with Gina Cho. And we initially reached out to Gina last season when we were thinking about doing the mental health awareness series, and then thought it would be great if we could do an actual full episode with her because she has so much to share, not only about her personal career journey, but also about her mindfulness practice, her book called The Anxious Lawyer, and her business now helping attorneys, law firms and many others learn more about mindfulness and diversity. And so we're going to do something a little different with due diligence today, and that is to share a short meditation with you. So this is one of Gina's meditations, and we'll provide a link to it in our show notes as well in case you want to go back to it or not necessarily follow our mellifluous voices while you do it. But in case you do, we wanted to show you a great simple meditation that if you're starting meditation for the first time, it's a really good place to start. If you're getting back to meditation after time off, maybe this will give you the boost you need to pick up that practice again. So we hope you enjoy it. First, start by finding a space where it's relatively quiet and free from distractions. It's important not to get too focused on finding the perfect condition for practice. Aim for good enough. Many lawyers enjoy doing the meditation practice in the car, for example, in the morning before walking into the office, or at the end of the day before driving home. It's generally best to choose a time and a space where you can practice every day to create a habit.
Second, find something to sit on. Really, any chair will do. While you certainly can purchase meditation cushions, benches, and other props, it's best to keep things simple in the beginning and just sit on something that's comfortable. It's also helpful to set a timer. Let's start with 5 minutes.
Third, close your eyes. You can also choose to keep your eyes slightly open and find a spot to focus on 3 to 4 feet in front of you. But generally, it's easiest to simply close the eyes.
Fourth, bring your attention to the breath. Choose the part of the body where you can most notice the sensations of the breath. This may be the nostrils, chest, stomach, or elsewhere.
Fifth, continue to rest your attention on the breath. Inevitably, the mind will wander. This is natural. Don't get upset with yourself or judge yourself. Thinking is very natural during meditation. With a sense of friendliness, gently guide your attention back to the breath.
And sixth, continue to follow the breath until your timer goes off. We hope you enjoyed this short meditation, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Personal Jurisdiction is powered and distributed by Simplecast. You don't have to wait until next week to hear more. You can find us online at personaljxpod.com and on Twitter at personaljxpod. Don't forget to subscribe to Personal Jurisdiction on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen so that you can be updated on the latest and greatest from Personal Jurisdiction. If you like what you hear, make sure to rate us 5 stars and leave a positive review so that other listeners can find our show too.